ॐ आप्यायन्तु ममाङ्गानि वाक् प्रणश्चक्षुश्रोत्रम् अतो बलमिन्द्रियाणि च सर्वाणि सर्वं ब्रह्मोपनिषदाम् माहं ब्रह्म निराकुर्याम् मा ब्रह्म निराकरोत् अनिराकरणमस्तु अनिराकरणं मेऽस्तु तदात्मने निरते य उपनिषत्सु धर्मास्ते मयि सन्तु ते मयि सन्तु ॐ शान्ति 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 मे माय लिम्स स्पीच ears, eyes, and all other senses be made strong in Brahman. May they experience the strength allotted to them for this life. All are derived from the Upanishads. May I never deny Brahman. May Brahman never deny me. May there never be any denial at all. Never, at least from me. And may all of the virtues that dwell in the Upanishads be found in me, who am devoted to the Atman. Om peace, peace, peace. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha viryam karavavahai Tejasvinavadhetamastu Mavinvishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being, may the Divine Being
support and nourish us as Mother and Father.
May we have the strength and skill
to study together the art of spirituality.
May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all. This morning we have the seventh in the series of sages of the Upanishads. And this is the final lesson that Sanat Kumara gives to Narada. And I have to say that it's my favorite. Not only of all of the lessons that Sanat Kumara gives, but even amongst the Upanishadic treasures themselves, I find this to be one of my most favorites. So, I hope I can convey to you something of my enthusiasm. You remember that we have been studying the dialogue, with those of you who have been here, most of you have, we've been studying the dialogue between the boy sage, the child teacher, Sanat Kumara, which that's what his name means, and Narada, the Devarshi. Devarshi is a rishi who has a divine origin and who belongs to a heavenly realm. So Narada himself is an advanced soul, relatively speaking, and Narada has come to this traditional teacher to learn more, to enhance and inspire his spiritual path. The boy, I mentioned before in the beginning that the figure of a child teacher is found in many faiths of the world. It's an old archetype that out of the mouths of babes, in the Bible you have that, and in many faiths they have this idea that the child, being innocent, being pure, having come without yet becoming involved in Maya, must somehow have the secret knowledge to give. And we mentioned, if you remember, with the role of whimsy, that we find in this particular dialogue, as in many of the others in the Upanishads, that the sages are not taking themselves over seriously. That tremendous weight plodding along that you find in the Buddhist scripture is not here. And you are relieved to know that, after all, the sages enjoy jokes, and they are not taking it all in too great a stride. Well, in Taoism, you have a very straightforward philosophical pronouncement from Lao Tzu, about whom we know nothing, almost nothing. And in Buddhism, as I mentioned, there are plodding, long dialogues. Very little of relief, of a cosmic relief in Islam, especially in Islam. You have to go to the Sufis to find something a little bit lighter than the Islamic pedagogy. Strictness. So, there is whimsy in the Upanishads. Not a whole lot of it. There are passages like this which say, the gods enjoy puns. And there's some punning is done there. Yeah, so it said, this is, means this, this means that, because the gods enjoy puns. Well, we're glad that the gods enjoy puns, because we do. And one of the reasons why the Upanishads have been as popular as they have, though they haven't been very popular, is because of stories like this one, incidents and dialogues like this. Story means a great deal. Story in a religion is a great, great learning tool. I think one of the reasons why Christianity has been so successful in the world is because it's mainly a story. It has a beginning in history and supposedly an end in history. And it takes you through a saga of a people. It's the story of an agreement between God and the Jewish people, and then on down into the Christian revelation. It's just a continuous story. Now, you don't find much of that in the Upanishads, but there are a few stories, and they are a comic relief, or at least lighter vein than the heavy philosophy. And this story is one of those which has helped to make this particular Upanishad very well liked. Well, we'll go to the first first section of the last part of this lesson. This is section 23 of chapter 7 in the Upanishad. Yo vai bhuma tat sukham, nalpe sukham asti bhumaiva sukham, bhumatu eva vijignasitas iti, bhumana bhagava vijignasa iti. Vijignasa means try to learn, want to learn, seek to learn. The infinite is happiness. There's no happiness in anything small or finite. Only the infinite is happiness. But one must desire to understand the infinite. And Narada says, "Verily, sir, venerable sir, I desire to understand the infinite." Very appropriate response from the teacher's pupil to the teacher. Teacher says, "You must want to understand what I have said." And Narada says, "Yes, I want to understand what you have said." Now this is a celebrated passage, deservedly so, because the word puma has so many implications. Notice that it's used here in a very philosophical sense for the infinite. And there are ways of interpreting the infinite, which we'll go into. But he is saying that there is no happiness in the finite. So that infinite is being equated with happiness, joy, bliss. So what do we have? We have here, we have a formula. Sat equals ananda. You know that the description, not a description, it specifically disclaims being a description. It says Brahman can be hinted at by the three terms sat, chit, ananda. Being, consciousness, bliss. So here we have the first and the third equated. Being, the infinite, ultimate being, is bliss, is joy, is happiness. There is no happiness in the alpa. Alpa is the small. Bhuma is the big. So, he says, one must desire, one must try to understand this means. And Narada says, "Sir, I do desire to understand what it means." I recently had a conversation on the telephone with somebody who always likes to argue with me. Loves to argue with me. And she said, "You know, this is your Vedic cosmology is all wrong." I said, "Oh, isn't that interesting?" And she said, "The scientists have proved it." And she has sent me a whole sheaf of articles about how the universe is expanding forever. That's the latest scientific conclusion. The Big Bang people, all the cosmologists, have got together and they have decided that not that the universe was going to expand and then contract as it was thought for some decades. The universe now is expected to simply go on expanding forever. Now, that's the word that's used, forever. And I have to point out to you that forever or eternity can be used in two different senses. It can mean something which goes on for a long, 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 long time. So long that nobody can count it, nobody can reckon it, nobody can figure it out or understand it or comprehend it. Or eternity, infinity, pretty much the same argument for both. Infinity is something which has nothing to do with time, nothing to do with space. And, of course, Sanat Kumara wants Narada to understand this word in that latter sense, in the sense of being something which cannot even be encompassed in the terms referring to time and space. So, this universe, according to the physicists today, now what will it be tomorrow? But today, the physicists are saying, that this universe is going to go on getting larger and larger and larger. I wish they had said indefinitely. That would have meant something. Indefinitely. You could say, I don't know. I put an end to it. But to say infinitely is going, forever is going to, you don't know what forever is. Who's going to be around to watch to see whether it's there forever? So, I cannot, she doesn't have this, my correspondence, doesn't have a background in Vedanta where I can try to explain to her that in the Vedic picture, the universe is going to go on expanding, and you know what they say in the article? To the end. End? You said it's going to span forever, and then you say end?
Yes, there's your contraction.
Exactly. I mean, what happens when it comes to the end?
Then we say, it'll go. With the Big Bang, you've got to say, what bang?
Right. No. So, at the end there, what it will do is, it will, according to us, it will shrink, you know, it will return unmanifest and begin another cycle of expansion. And this will go on and on. Now, I want to point out something interesting to you. The mathematical symbol, what's the mathematical symbol for infinity?
Mm-hmm. The Mobius strip.
Now look what it does. It goes back and forth. It's not a line that goes all the way across the page. It's a line that goes back and forth.
Samji, I may be correct here if I'm wrong, but isn't it open loop on one right side?
Yeah, that's what I thought. Like
this is not is a closed loop. It's an open loop.
Oh, is it? Is it?
Break
yes.
On the right side.
Yeah. Right side is an open loop.
Oh, is it?
And therefore yes. There is a room for expansion.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was this. Oh, all right. So then what does it mean then?
That means there's a room for expansion.
Oh, there's room
for expansion. One side is closed, but the other side is open. So
oh, I see. Okay.
That's the way.
Well, I'll draw it my way. They want to draw it their way. I'll draw it my way.
Put the break in the middle so that it's an illusion. And I think that says it a little more clearly.
Well, that's a nice idea. That break in the middle is the illusion. I'm sorry I got it wrong, though. I had it in my mind. My math is not up to date. I had it in mind as it being a closed one, but that was wishful thinking. the synonyms for Bhuma are most interesting. The meanings that we'd use in English for the way Bhuma is used in the Sanskrit literature. It could be translated by these words, grand, abundant, superlative, vast, and so on. These are equivalents to the idea of infinite in the case of Bhuma. So I like, for instance, the term vast. That's short, and I can easily understand it. The Bhuma is the vast. And what Sanat Kumar is saying is anything that strikes you as being vast, expansive, expanding and liberating and freeing can be called Bhuma. Sri Ramakrishna said at one time, speaking of his spiritual experiences, he said, I once went into a meadow where suddenly the horizon became just vast, open expanse. And he said, it put me into samadhi. So by the feeling of the vast, the feeling of the expansive, we enhance our appreciation of that which is beyond all space. You understand? That's the importance of hinting at it with a word like this. Now the question arises, does it mean, when he says infinite, does it, or vast, does it mean physically? Otherwise, a little man like me is hopeless. I'm small. And I used to love miniature things. And so the question is there any advantage or any beauty or any bliss, particular bliss, in being large? And you know as well as I do that it cannot simply mean physical vastness. And yet we don't completely overlook the concept of physicality in the vastness. We don't recognize people's size to be any indication of their spirituality or their happiness necessarily. And yet, you know, as I pointed out in one previous session, people like to build and buy large homes. They like to move from small apartments to larger ones. And that feeling of freedom, the feeling of space and freedom and expansion, is a part of our hope in life. It's a part of our aspiration. Which means what? We must somehow be pushing towards total limitlessness. We push the limits so that we can be ultimately limitless. Is there any happiness involved in being mentally large? You know? Suppose we say that, well, it applies to the intellect, it applies to the mind, those who are large-minded, those who have lots of brain cells, those who have plenty of intellect and judgment, good judgment, acumen, and so on and so forth. These wide-minded people are happier than others. Well, let me tell you, I worked for a year in an institution for the mentally handicapped, and hundreds of them are very happy. They sit all day long and just laugh, giggle, and enjoy themselves. So, mentally too, you cannot say that it applies to the mind, this bhuma. It doesn't apply to the mind always. Some very, very unintelligent people are quite happy. There was a book came out not very long, too long ago, many years ago. Who wrote that book? Small is Beautiful. Remember that book? I don't remember the name of the author. But he made the claim that small things are the best. He went around the cultural map and picked out things which were small and treasured. The diamond, you know. Diamond is a very small thing. It takes a heap of coins, a big heap of coins, to make the value of a diamond. But the diamond is small. So, again, I'm trying to show that it's not the physical size so much, it's not the size that makes bhuma, it's the tendency or aspiration to expand and to feel and know oneself as large. What is it that makes the difference in size between one person and another, between one person's experience and another, between one thing and another? What makes the difference? Our sense experience, what we take in through our senses, and our body consciousness. If we did not have body consciousness, we would not feel anywhere near the number of differences between large and small that we feel. And also if we didn't have sense experience. I lived for a year in Texas where everything is larger than everything anywhere else. Including the roaches. larger than you've ever seen in Georgia. And I have no respect for, I shouldn't say I have no respect for Texas. I have no respect for the claim that large things are the best. So, we know that we don't mean that. What Sanat Kumara is asking Narada to do is to realize a different state of consciousness. He says there's no happiness in the Alpa. The Alpa is the limited. So, wherever the feeling of limitation comes, whether it's in the body, whether it's in the mind, or the intellect, or whether it's in the outward universe, wherever a feeling of limitation comes, you know that you haven't reached the ultimate state of consciousness, the desirable, the blissful state of consciousness. The blissful state of consciousness will be one where size is not considered, but which in which you feel the total limitlessness of Brahman. That is what he's trying to get Narada to understand. So we know, in this case then, that the vast, when he speaks of the Bhuma or the vast, he is trying to get us to push the sense that we have of limitedness in all directions and realize that which has no limits. I've drawn a little thing here which I call, a little symbol, which I call the self sense. If this is our self, the conscious self, the ego, or not emphasizing ego so much, but the little self, let's say self with a small s. If this is self with a small s, it seeks by means of various sorts to spread itself out in all directions. This is what that indicates. It feels limited, either by body, or by mind, or by its world, or its a dwelling place, or whatever limitations it feels put upon it, it feels. Now, if it can erase the outer circle, then it goes to the edges of the board. It goes beyond that. It goes to the infinite. And that is why we are told that the vast is the happy, because the vast is luring us, in encouraging us to go to that which has no size at all. All right, now let's come to the next verse. And he says, I'm not going to read the whole Sanskrit verse, but it starts, yatra nanyat pasyati nanyat srinoti nanyat vijanati tadbhuma. Sanat Kunwara says, where one sees nothing else, hears nothing else, knows nothing else, understands nothing else, that is the infinite. But where one sees something else, hears something else, understands something else, that is the finite, that's the small, alpa. Verily, and then I'm going to, not ready for the next part yet. So, where there is a feeling of otherness, where you have a feeling that somebody is standing apart from you, beside you, you may know that there you have not reached the Bhuma. The Alpa is still with us when we feel the presence of something else, something other than ourselves. See how we're bound there. What's outside the circle is not ourselves. What are these others? A different gender? A different age, chronological age, different race, somebody's of a different color, of a different caste, somebody's of a different religion, different persuasion, belongs to a different nation. Different. Everywhere we look, all around us in our life, something different. This one is different from me. And now the ultimate aspiration of Vedanta is to erase all these. I mean, I have to face you with the facts. That's the aspiration. You say, well, my whole life will go to pieces if I can't distinguish myself from somebody else. Yes, the human life does go eventually into the divine life and is swallowed up there. The waves go back into the ocean. Yes, yes. If all the waves stood up and said, oh, don't knock me down, don't let me fall, I will collapse. Just think how foolish the waves would be. Where do the waves go? They go back into the ocean. Where does human life go? It goes back into the divine. So we need not be so nervous and worried about the fact that our otherness sense eventually has to disappear. That's the way it is. We cannot remain separated from others and forever. So long, there's another sense, there's another Upanishad passage in the Katha Upanishad, which is very popular. I suppose it's much better known than this one. The teacher there, I've forgotten which teacher it is, he says, so long as there remains the slightest difference, the difference of a hair, width of a hair between you and something else, you and another, there will be fear. Fear in this world will last so long as there is the hair's breadth separation between you and the other. Duality, the slightest hint of duality, fear remains. So this is what we're after. We're after the absence of fear, because bliss, ananda, or huma, or bliss, the infinity, cannot come so long as there is fear. They're absolutely opposite. Now, in this verse, Narada asks a very legitimate question. He turns to Sanat Kumara and asks, is there something behind this bhuma? What is the substratum of the bhuma? Now this is very interesting, because the teacher accepts the student's goof and then corrects it. The student has made a misstatement. You see, we are always trying to find out what is under something. The house sits on the ground, the soil. In the soil, so many layers, sits on stone and gravel, and the smaller stones sit on the larger stones, and the larger stones sit on, and so on, down to the bottom of the earth, the center of the earth, and the whole thing sits on gravity and magnetism. The whole universe is supported by the gravitational element of gravity, the universe, which is holding everything together, the physics. So it's quite natural for us to ask, when we're told about something, what's behind it? The trouble is that most of the dualistic religions have never asked what's behind God. They've been content to rest with the personal God. Oh, God created the universe. Well, then who created God? Narada has the sense to ask a perfectly legitimate question. Have you told me about the absolute? have you told me the ultimate? Or is there something on which the Bhuma is established? And he's right in form. We wish that all of the religions of the world would ask, is there something behind Allah? Is there something behind Jehovah? Is there something on which your ultimate reality that you would worship is established? Now, Sanat Kumara answers the question as if it were a sensible question. Swami Vivekananda and others, teachers, have been more abrupt. They have said to him, you're answering a question which, you're asking a question which makes no sense. Your question itself is illogical. But Sanat Kumara doesn't do that. He says, what does he say? Verily, Venerable Sir asks, Venerable Sir asks Narada, on what is the Bhuma established? And Narada replies, on its own greatness. He answers the question. He doesn't slap the student's face. He answers the question. He says, on its own greatness, or not even on its greatness. Let me read his complete reply. Here on earth, people call cows and horses, elephants and gold, slaves and wives, fields and houses, greatness. I do not speak thus. I do not speak thus, said he. For in that case, one thing is established on another. See how razor sharp the logic is here. He's peeling Narada's mind back, his question back, to show him the unintelligent basis from which it arises. You are thinking of the Bhuma, you are thinking of this Brahman as something in the world, like people have their greatness established in their houses and their chariots and their slaves and their wives and so on, and you think that's greatness. I am not talking about that kind of greatness, and therefore I say that this is not one thing established on another. It is established on its own greatness. It needs nothing else to support it. You get the idea? Now this is a very important principle because Shankaracharya has defined reality in four ways. Those who were with us in the last Thursday's class will remember that Shankara had given us four categories of reality. The Vyabharika and the Pratibhasika and the Tuccha and and Paramarthika. Paramarthika is the supreme reality. Vyavaharika is the illusory reality. And then imaginative reality. Then the other two are the pragmatic and this one. It's called Tuccha Satta. And it consists of verbal reality. What is verbal reality? It wasn't important Thursday night, but it's important to today. If I say to you, the barren woman's son, for just a few minutes, a few seconds, in your mind, there exists something because you don't immediately protest it. So for a few seconds, there is something which exists called barren woman's son. Narada is saying to Sanat Kumara, what is the ultimate established on? The words themselves are contradictory. If it is ultimate, how can it be established on anything else? So he's asking a nonsensical question, a question which has reality for just those few seconds until you, your mind picks it up and judges it and analyzes and realizes the truth of it. That is, the falsity of it, rather. So this is a very good example of how the teacher has to accept the avidya which pervades the mind of the student and accepts it for a long, long time and deals with that until the student himself can understand that he is making assumptions which are totally without basis. Do y'all follow me? So Narada is making one of those, showing his level of understanding. And Sanat Kumara is accepting it, and then he is tearing it to pieces, and we see before our eyes how tuccha satta, or verbal reality, can be dispersed. And that becomes very important at a later stage of spiritual life, when we become very close to the goal. We suddenly, it's like turning the staircase upside down. The staircase that's drawn so that you could go up or down. And you suddenly see that, why, it could be a downward staircase. It's that kind of aha experience that Narada's going to have when Sanat Kumara tears his establishment apart. So, now where am I? You see why I like this verse. Verse 25. Now, Sanat Kumara tries to help us with little steps. What he has told Narada is a big pill to swallow, a big jump, leap from here to the absolutely infinite, which has no other thing to support it, no other established basis, but is complete in itself. And so the teacher is going to help him a little bit. He tries to give him some smaller steps. And this is what he says in 25, section 25. That Bhuma, that infinite, is below. It is above. It's behind. It's in front. It's to the south, the north. It's to the east, it's to the west. Breaking the circle. Push beyond. Go up to the north, south, east, west. Front and behind. Explode your little globe of self-sense and understand where that is. You know, in the Christmas Eve service, we give Christ that kind of a dimension. Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ behind me, Christ above me, Christ within me, Christ. At the Christmas Eve service, we do that. We talk of the cosmic Christ in that little song and speak of the divine as being in all these different directions. So now he says, it is in front, it is to the south, it is to the north, it is indeed all this, this visible world. Then, having gone to the macrocosm, he turns it and goes to the microcosm. Aham, I indeed am below, I'm above, I'm to the south, I'm to the north, I'm behind, I'm in front. Aham. I am to the south. I am indeed all this. all this world. I am that. And the self sense has expanded to experience all this is myself. You do it. You feel yourself in certain people at certain times. You see yourself in what the dog does. You see yourself in what the cat does. You see yourself in what the birds do, flying and their freedom. You feel yourself at times down a long corridor. It gives you a feeling. I'm at the end of that corridor as well as this end. Or in a telescope, I'm at the other end of the telescope, or I'm at this end of the telescope. You feel these things in tiny little satoris from time to time to time. Little openings of aha. Now, what we're trying to do here is to grasp that in the long run, the whole of this universe is not different from myself. No other. Otherness goes. Alpa goes. Smallness goes. So fear goes. Atma. Atma. I am here everywhere. Atma. The self is everywhere. Swami Vivekananda harped on this topic. You know, he pushed it to its full. Said, as fear is the strength is the medicine for the world's disease. Strength is the one thing which will overcome our weakness, our fear, our smallness. And he never tired of saying, be fearless, be fearless. Stand on your own divinity and reveal itself to you, let it reveal itself to you. Now, here's the final verse. That Sanat Kumar instruction regard to the self. The self indeed is below, the self is above, the self is behind, the self is in front, and to the south and to the north. The self is all this world. Now, verily, he who sees this, who thinks this way, who understands this, he has pleasure in the self. He has delight in the self. Ananda becomes in the self. He has union in the self. He has joy in the self. He is independent, self-ruled. And he has unlimited freedom in all worlds. I think sometimes people ask, what is the whole purpose of Vedanta? What's the goal of Vedanta? Is it salvation? Is it world improvement? What is it? And I think the only word that we can really use is freedom. Freedom summarizes everything that Vedanta stands for. And it isn't realized until you get this state. But they who think differently from this are dependent on others, they're ruled by others, they live in perishable worlds. In all the worlds, they cannot move. They have no freedom. India used to harp on that theme, Swaraj. That's the word in here. Swaraj. What is Swaraj? Self-rule. Before independence came, you heard this cry from the Congress and from everybody, all the freedom fighters in India. Swaraj, Swaraj. That term is right here. It comes right out of this Upanishad. Self-ruling, self-rulement, self-independence. And those who think differently, they are in trouble. That's what it says. They are in trouble. Now, then, he says, Sri Ramakrishna says, bondage and freedom are of the mind. If you think you are free, and think means not superficially, if the whole lineup of your mind and intellect, if the whole your whole thought, right straight down through the whole of your being, is that you are free, free you are at this moment. If you think you are bound with all that strength of your conviction, bound you are. Bound you are. So, freedom and bondage are the mind. Make the mind one, and then see how quickly you'll be free. Well, there's one more verse in the lesson. We have time for that, so goes like this. For him who sees this, who thinks this, and who understands this, life breath springs from this, from the self, prana springs from the self, hope springs from the self, memory from the self, ether from the self, space, heat from the self, water from the self, appearance and disappearance from the self, food, strength, understanding, all of these, meditation, thought, determination, mind, speech, all from the self. Name comes from the self. Sacred hymns come from the self. Works come from the self. And this whole world. What is he doing? He's gone back to the beginning of his lesson. You remember, we took up each of these in succession. And he said that, the teacher said that one, the next one was greater than the last one. And we saw that that was kind of a come on, because we couldn't really figure out why one was greater than the other. So he's gone back through the whole series of things which he thought were important. And there he traced them to Brahman. All were from Brahman. This comes from Brahman, that comes from the silver, nine forms, all these come from Brahman. And now what's he done? Aham and Brahman are not different. Aham Brahmasmi. I am Brahman. But these that come from the self. The Brahman and the self now are not different. They have become one. And all of these things, prana, heat, and things that make up the cosmos, all of these things have come from aham, atman. Atman. That's the word in this verse. Atman. From atman, all these things come. Brahman and atman the same. That's the whole lesson of monism. Brahman and Atman are the same. So, he has gone back to over the whole series. And it came from Sat, or Brahman, in the beginning, the real, and now it springs from the Atman. Now, there's a second part of the verse which gives us a little bit of trouble. The Upanishads are like this. If they were as clear and straight as I've presented the verses this morning, without any hitches, we would have, we'd probably all be enlightened sitting here this morning. But there are things which come in to muddle the picture, unfortunately. Don't tell the Orthodox people that I said this. But there are things that come in to muddle. And this is what it says. On this, there is the following verse from some other Upanishad, some other part of the Veda, probably. He who sees this does not see death, nor illness, nor any sorrow. He who sees this sees everything and obtains everything everywhere. No illness? I am constantly being badgered by people. Well, not constantly. I am occasionally badgered by people who say, you speak of all these great souls. Sri Ramakrishna died of a cancer, throat of cancer. Throat. So many of his disciples were ill. They were ill at the end. They were unable to cure their illness. And if they were knowers of God, why are they ill? So that bothers a lot of people. And I'm not going to go into a lot of it this morning. I don't have time. But you know that there are two ways of looking at it. One is, and I should ask Bhagirath about this one. One is to keep oneself so constantly aware of the spirit of the non-physical, that the mind resists and stays away from those things which tend to make you ill. You preserve, if you are wise and intelligent, you try to preserve this body and all of the your environment from contaminating and corrupting influences. Okay, you do that. That's just common sense. So, in one sense, he who sees this doesn't see death nor illness because he's very careful. And he lives a long time, and there are people who say that they've lived, you know, over 150 years, things like that. Certainly no sorrow. I think we can say that the sorrow claim is valid. But I do not think that the Upanishad can promise you total physical health, that you will always be free forever from any kind of illness, and unless you take it in the figurative sense, that he being or she being detached from the body, even if the body is ill, it does not affect the person fundamentally. That's another way of expanding it. Well, he goes on. He is one. He becomes threefold. What's that? What's the threefold? He, Brahman, the self, the Atman, the beginning, the primal being, is one. He becomes threefold. What? Come on. Prakriti, what?
Three gunas.
What is there? Sleeping, everybody. Sleeping this morning. Becomes the gunas. Okay, threefold. Fivefold. What's that?
Senses.
The senses. Sense organs and motor organs. Fivefold. Then sevenfold. Apertures in the body. Apertures. Some say ninefold. Apertures in the body. Then again, he's called 11-fold, 111-fold, and 20,000-fold. Those are just, you know, scatter dust. He becomes infinitely complex. He becomes multiple all over the universe. And then he says, when nourishment is pure, nature is pure. Now there's your illness clue or key. When nourishment is pure, nature is pure. When nature is pure, memory becomes firm. When memory remains firm, there is release from all knots of the heart. And my memory is beginning to become infirm, and so I suppose I shall have knots in the heart. You know, I'm not expecting that. To such a one who has his stains wiped away, stains all wiped away, the venerable Sanat Kumara shows the further shore of darkness. It's the writer or the author of the Upanishad stepping outside the form of Sanat Kumara, or perhaps Sanat Kumara putting his own name in the end. That's a common thing. He, the venerable Sanat Kumara, that's me, shows the further shore of darkness. Beyond darkness he takes us. So, and my question I leave with you, are you looking for freedom of some kind or of every kind? Are you looking for peace? Are you looking for beauty? Finality? Meaning, yourself, ultimate, you'll find it here in the Upanishad. I have to make a couple of remarks. I think I'll pass this around for you to see before you get up, all of you to look at. First of all, though, some people are taking out videotapes and keeping them after seeing them. When you have finished seeing the video, please, if you can, return it so that others can take it out. This is a taken from the web. It's a picture, a photo of Christmas Eve at Bellarmont. The Christmas Eve celebration at our headquarters, our big temple. This is on the side of the temple. This is not the altar, main altar. This is always done over on the right side of the large temple. And they set up this altar. And this picture, the picture which is being worshipped here of Madonna and Child, is the one, it's a replica of the one Sri Ramakrishna was meditating on when he had the vision of Christ. So that's what's on the top picture. I was there for that celebration 2 years, for 2 years, and they asked me to read from the Bible, and take prominent part in the worship service.
Does Thursday night begin a new series?
We began last Thursday. We didn't get very far. You didn't miss much.
What's the title of it again?
Self-knowledge. Atma-bodha, or self-knowledge, is the text. You know. And that is a book which we hope to use discriminately. We're not going to go straight through it as it's printed. We're going to take the actual text, Sanskrit text first, then try to learn a few Sanskrit terms, if those who wish to. Has it gone around this way?
Yes.
Okay. Would you care to introduce yourself and can you hear?
Sure.
Is Tarun?
Yes, thank you. My name is Tarun. And this is my
first time. You what?
My friend Abe Wong suggested that I meet you.
Interesting. All right, let us say our benediction. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
Om peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere.